tomorrow. Think about that. Here's Banfield.
You ever hear that expression, you win some, you lose some? Usually I think people said it to you to make you feel better when something crappy happened to you, right? But in the Karen Reed trial today, it played out, the win some, lose some principle. Because in the prosecutor's case against Karen Reed in this retrial, he lost some, right? He lost some in that the lead investigator is dumped, fired for being dirty, potty-mouthed, and gross in all his text messages about Karen Reed hours into actually beginning an investigation into her, right? It's Michael Proctor, out, gone. So that's real hard in a murder trial when your lead investigator is turfed, right? Can't even put him on the stand because all that stuff will come in. You don't want that. But while that's a huge loss, boy, did that prosecutor ever have a big gain. In Karen Reed's own words. Because that's something in trial number one they did not have. They did not have Karen Reed doing TV interview after TV interview that they could just play in court. And today they played something that doesn't bode well for Karen. I'm going to play it for you. I'd love to get your opinion on it. That's coming up in just a moment. Also, this is something I never thought I'd say. Is there like an X-Files aspect to the Vatican? I know. First of all, the news is big on the passing of the Pope and who the next Pope is going to be. But for a lot of people in the true crime community and a lot of people in the UFO community, the news is big because they want the archives opened up. And as it turns out, there is a massive vault under Vatican City. Did you know? 50 miles of shelving. Look at these pictures. It's crazy. 50 miles of shelving under the Vatican. And a lot of people think there are things on those shelves that hold secrets to extraterrestrial activity that the Vatican knows about. I know, it's a lot to take in. But today I got an expert, and we're going to discuss whether a new pope might open that vault. Also, there is a brazen criminal that is just wantonly trashing cars in this beautiful little seaside town in Massachusetts. Just one after the other, almost two dozen cars. Smash, 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 glass, windows. Look at this damage. Just bang, bang, bang everywhere. All these different cars. And the owners are like super mad, as they would be. So it turns out they finally caught the guy. On camera. The guy wasn't even like wearing a mask or a disguise or anything. It was full frontal. They caught him. They know who he is. So why can't they actually bring him in and charge him? It is a fabulous little mystery. I'm going to play it all out for you tonight, but here's where I'm going to start. One of the biggest ways that Karen Reed's retrial is different from her mistrial is the absence of a witness that no self-respecting prosecutor would ever dare to hold a murder trial without: the top cop, the lead investigator. And for Karen Reed, it's this guy, Massachusetts State Trooper Michael Proctor, who got himself fired for, among other things, the vulgar text messages that he sent about Karen within hours of starting to investigate Karen. And when all that went down, I said to myself, game over, Karen walks. But you know what they say, when one door closes, another door opens. And that brand new prosecutor who's on board got a brand new gift while building his case. Karen Reed's TV interviews. Karen talked and talked and talked in front of all sorts of cameras about the victim and about the victim's mother. And if there is one thing that no one should ever do, it is insult someone's mom, especially a grieving mom. And that is what Karen appeared to do in one of her TV interviews. And today that damning clip was played for the jury, my friends, and I am going to play it for you in a moment. It was not good, not even in the least. And neither was the clip where Karen tells an interviewer that she was buzzed on vodka tonics the night that the police say she ran down her boyfriend. And speaking of that boyfriend, John O'Keefe, it is amazing. It is amazing that they were still together the night that he died. John would barely even take Karen's calls in the last full day of his life. And their text messages, they made it seem like their relationship was right in the toilet. A state trooper read them out loud on the stand today.
All right, this is from Karen Reed to John O'Keefe. You've really hurt me this time. This is from the defendant to John O'Keefe. I feel pretty good about how this morning went down. I know you said sorry, but it really stung, especially when I've been trying pretty hard lately. I feel like a loser turning around, just coming back over after everything you said. At 2:24, 17 p.m., the defendant calls John, and the call is rejected. From the defendant to John O'Keefe, tell me if you're interested in someone else. Can't think of any other reason you've been like this. From John O'Keefe to the defendant, things haven't been great between us for a while. Ever consider that? At 2:28, 40 p.m., the defendant calls John. That call is rejected. From the defendant to John O'Keefe, last night you're basically like, yeah, what about when we talk about the future? So why don't you just admit you're not into so much anymore? John O'Keefe to the defendant, sick of always arguing and fighting. It's been weekly for several months now. So yeah, I'm not as quick to jump back into being lovey-dovey as you apparently. 2:32, 28 p.m. on the 28th. At 2:32, 47 p.m., the defendant calls John. That call is rejected. John O'Keefe to the defendant, OMG, stop calling. 2:34, 29 p.m., the defendant calls John. He rejects the call. John O'Keefe to Karen, the defendant, I'm not answering, stop calling. At 2:50, 56 p.m., the defendant calls John. The call is rejected. At 2:51, 13 p.m., the defendant calls John. It's rejected. 2:52, 37 p.m., John calls the defendant. It's not answered. At 2:53, 56, the defendant calls John. Again, not answered. The defendant, John O'Keefe, you seriously cannot pick up the phone for 2 seconds.
Well, O'Keefe eventually did pick up the phone, but the text barrage, that did not stop. Also, a friend of O'Keefe's testified today that Karen did not want other women hanging around her boyfriend. I'm joined now by someone who is either wishing that he was Karen Reed's lawyer or thanking God that he isn't. He's a superstar lawyer himself and co-host of the podcasts Reasonable Doubt and Two Angry Men. Mark Garagos, good to have you here. Oops, ick, never good when you have a text exchange like that and like 12 to 14 hours later, your boyfriend is dead.
Well, I get that. I mean, the timing is not good, but there was nothing in that that isn't more than somebody who seems to be incredibly, what do the kids say now, needy or thirsty. I mean, it wasn't like, it's annoying. It's clearly harassing, but I don't think that you can make the leap just from that. I still, like I told you the night before last, if I'm picking a side on this retrial, I'm picking the defense.
Well, how about the notion that she seems angry and unhinged, and that would correlate with somebody who put her car in reverse and went 24 miles an hour for 60 feet while hammered amidst this really angry day of fighting?
Yeah, it's a great case if you forget about everything that happened in between and that we've learned about afterwards. You've got other people, you've got people, as we discussed, trolling for how long, what was it, how's long in the cold. You've got people who've got bloody knuckles. You've got, frankly, an investigation that appears to me to be inflamed and prejudiced towards her from the get-go. So, I mean, it's not a great day for the defense, but there were no knockout blows here. In fact, I think you could make an argument that most of this stuff is just, you know, would have run off a duck's back, so to speak, if he hadn't ended up dead. I mean, there's nothing in those texts, Ashley, that when you can't get a hold of me to be on your show, that you don't do the same. I mean, how many times have I rejected you know, calls by you to get on the A block. I mean, you know, does that mean you're going to run me over?
Touche. Well, yes, there have been days where yes,
maybe you would run me over, but actually, you've been very thirsty on occasion when I'm not answering calls. So,
you know how much I love you, right? So, here's the other thing that did not go well for Karen today. Let's just put aside the texts and everybody on the jury says, "Oh, I've been there before." Yikes! This is something exactly. I don't know a lot of people have been at before. This is a clip on the Hulu documentary, an Investigation ID documentary, where Karen's being interviewed by the producer, and she is describing the mother of John O'Keefe within hours of finding out that John is dead. She's over at John O'Keefe's house. Karen comes over to that house and describes John's mom in the kitchen leaning over the kitchen island and describing what she saw in the hospital when she had to see John's body. So again, a mom is describing John's body, and this is how Karen described it to the interviewer. Let's play the clip.
And his mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, "I think it looks like he got hit by a car. He looks like he got hit by a car."
So that hurts. I watched that documentary, and at that very moment, Mark Garagos, I said, oh boy, that's going to be played in her trial. She's literally mocking and deriding the dead man's mom within hours of learning that her son was dead. So they played that for the jury today. What's your impression of how that will land?
We also discussed this a little bit the other night, and my feeling is that there's no reason to put her on now, because you can probably, under what's called the rule of completeness, which means if the prosecution plays one portion of something, you can play an expanded version. Under the rule of completeness, I don't know why you'd put her on. And frankly, if that's the worst thing, it would be a lot worse if you put her on the stand and had her cross-examined. So I would take that body blow if I'm Alan Jackson for the upside of getting some of the other stuff in.
You think it weighs in her favor, it inures to her favor, all the things she was able to get into the jury pool, and then this comes in as a soundbite?
Yes. If this coming in as a soundbite, to me, if you're doing a cost-benefit analysis on this, this coming in and being hurt by it, because clearly you're hurt by it. It's not a good day. You wouldn't, if you're scripting it for the defense, you're not going to say, yes, I want this to happen. But would I take that body blow versus putting her on the stand to get beat up by a very able prosecutor? I'll take that trade all day, every day.
Speaking of on the stand, the prosecutor this time round put John O'Keefe's mom on the stand. They did not put her on the stand the first trial, but the new prosecutor did put her on the stand. It was very sad. She was, you know, as a grieving mother would be, crying and sniffling and needing a break, etc. And I wondered if you saw the value in it for what it was. I'm guessing it was to humanize John O'Keefe. But do you see something else?
No, I think that when you bookend her mocking the mother and putting the mother up there, it just emphasizes it's a bad fact, and it's a character assassination. I mean, in any circumstantial evidence case, it's interesting. I was bantering about earlier today about Scott Peterson, and when you don't have the circumstantial evidence you need, what you need to do is you need to, as a prosecutor, you assassinate the character. I always say it's a character assassination block. Judge's job is to filter that out, or to make the prosecutor say, or to hold their feet to the fire and say, you tell me how this is more probative than prejudicial, and I'll let it in. Obviously, the judge felt it was, and that's why it was let in. It doesn't go, or it doesn't speak to what traditionally is relevant in a circumstantial evidence case, but I understand, and most judges would allow this kind of thing in, even though they're really, in terms of relevance, it's not that relevant.
Well, it's reverberating in my ears, though, the tone and the snarl and the way imitates the mother.
Exactly. Ooh. What it, the whole idea of it is to inflame. I mean, that's by definition what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to turn you off. You're not supposed to. You know, the whole idea of a jury trial is you have jurors in the box, and the idea is, do they want to help your client or not help your client from the defense standpoint? From the prosecution standpoint, it's make the person into a villain. It's to make them, if you can, into an inanimate
unlikable
object. Unlikable. Exactly. And that's what they're doing.
So guess what? You and I talked, yesterday or the day before? I lose track of the days. And you said, boy, Ashley, I would really like to know what the breakdown was in gender for who voted for guilty and who voted for not guilty in the deadlocked jury on trial one. And asking, you shall receive, Mark Garagos, because we had a juror from trial number one on the show last night, and he answered that question. Let's roll it. So it wasn't palpable that all the women, were voting guilty and all the men were voting not guilty. It wasn't obvious like that.
No, it was not obvious. It was not obvious that. If anything, if I were to guess, and again, I'm not 100% sure because we deliberated on this motion, essentially is that we're about 50-50.
What do you think about that?
50-50, I suspected. However, did you ask the follow-up question? Was it gender, or what was the breakout on gender?
Yeah. So that was what he was actually answering. It took a while to get it out of him, but that was the question I wanted to know was, what about men versus women? Were more of the women anti-Karen and more of the men pro-Karen? He said, no, it was almost imperceivable how people felt. There was absolutely nothing that came to him that lined up in that respect.
That's fascinating to me, because usually, you and I have discussed this in a lot of these cases, usually the rule of thumb is women are harder on women. And especially, there's an adage in the law that a good-looking woman is the toughest defendant to defend, because you just have a whole lot of emotions that are working against you. But here, it does not appear that that was the case. Or, there's another theory that I could use, but I'll save it for tomorrow night.
Oh, there's a tease. I was going to say, you're right about that. I think that's why they put Casey Anthony in the library outfits and no makeup and terrible hair. She just looked nothing like what she looked like in all her, wet T-shirt contest pictures. Mark Garagos, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ashley. I always love being here. Thank you.
Well, we love having you too. Good friend of the show. Okay, I have one thing I need to tell you before I go to break. It's breaking news out of Idaho. The quadruple murder case is big news tonight. It looks like Brian Koberger is going to face a possible death penalty after all. You'll probably remember that his lawyers had asked the judge, if Brian's found guilty, can you please take the death penalty off the table? Based on the fact that our client is autistic. The state had said, no. Only, quote, intellectual impairment, end quote, makes the death penalty unconstitutional, not autism. And the judge agreed. However, there was some good news for Koberger's defense team. The judge ruled that some of that 911 call that was made after the murders, remember the discovery of the murders, the 911 call, some of it will be redacted based on hearsay. We do not know which parts will be redacted, but the judge did say that the jury can have the entire transcript for reference. So win some, you lose some. Time is ticking, by the way, for Koberger, because his trial is set to begin August 11th. That is about 3.5 months from now. Still ahead, all eyes are on Vatican City for obvious reasons. But we are more concerned tonight with what is under Vatican City, like the 50 miles of archives that could prove once and for all that we are not alone. I'm not talking about evidence of God here. I'm actually talking about UFOs. And yes, there is a connection to the Vatican. Will the new Pope open the vault and reveal the secrets that even our government seems to know exist? That's next. Secret that beneath Vatican City, there are more than 50 miles of shelving containing documents and archives collected and heavily guarded over the centuries. What is a secret, though, is what is contained in many of those archives. The Catholic Church has had centuries of fascination with astronomy, and a lot of people say the Church knows about extraterrestrial activity that they've been keeping a secret. So while the passing of the Pope was going to have millions of people looking to the sky for white or black smoke from the conclave, UFO enthusiasts who look to the sky all the time are hoping to see something else. The archives lining those 50 miles of shelving. They want to see them. A while back, News Nation reported a claim from a Pentagon whistleblower that back during World War II, Pope Pius XII tipped off the U.S. government about the recovery of a partially intact UFO that Benito Mussolini's Italian government had discovered. So will the new pope open the vault and share the secrets below the Vatican? I'm joined now by the host of UFO Witness on Discovery Plus, Ben Hansen. Ben, it is so, like, crazy to think that there is a nexus between the Vatican and UFOs, but that's something that was actually discussed in testimony before Congress.
Yeah, it sounds like it's like straight out of a Dan Brown novel, you know, Da Vinci Code stuff.
Yeah.
Is the Catholic Church involved in a cover-up, something they don't want their membership or the world to know? You know, David Grush comes out and he talks about this 1933 case where supposedly the U.S. military was tipped off, like you said. They come in, take this UFO, this object, take possession of it at the end of World War II. And allegedly, the Catholic Church has not only records of that, but perhaps going back to centuries, documentation of UFOs or perhaps alien visitation.
So here's what, you know, if P then Q, I'm thinking, why would they keep everything a secret? Because if, you know, their followers, their congregants, beyond Catholics, if people start to realize that it's not an Adam and Eve story and it's not just Earth and there's a lot more to it, there goes religion.
I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head, you know, with that theory, because the idea is the same, you know, concept perhaps that you talk about. Perhaps was Jesus married? Did he have children? The canonical, you know, doctrine of many religions is very kind of set in stone. And so to go back and kind of rewrite history and to say, okay, well, perhaps not only we're not the only ones in the universe, but what if they don't look like us? Right. You have, you know, scriptural reference to making God in man's image. So what if they don't really look like us? Would that mean that people lose their faith? Would that mean that they're going to kind of panic and give up on religion? And what about the authority of religion and membership? So all those questions is kind of what the theory is as to why perhaps they believe that either people are not ready for this or that they should indefinitely keep it covered up.
Or you have to rewrite a few books to incorporate the universe instead of just Earth, you know. But I am curious about the official position that the Catholic Church takes on extraterrestrial possibilities.
Well, it kind of depends on who you talk to, right? So the keeper of the records or the secretary to the prefect of the archives has come out and said that they absolutely do not. They don't know where Grush got this idea. They said they don't have any documentation of extraterrestrial life, and they're dissuading researchers from asking anymore. So there's kind of like a process, sort of like filing a Freedom of Information Act. You can petition the Vatican, see what they say. Will you let us into your archives? And they're saying, stop looking for it. We don't have any of that here. Now, I personally do know of people who have had access to archives. And I do know, according to them, that the Catholic Church has kept records of things such as demonic possession for centuries, very detailed records. But as to the UFO subject, that's more of a mystery. Like you had mentioned in the beginning, 50 miles of shelving, they probably don't even know what they have in there. And I highly doubt it's digitized.
That's my assumption. Yeah, I highly doubt it. Yeah, looking at the books, they're almost falling apart. I only have like 30 seconds left, but is there any hope that the new pontiff might be a little more transparent, might open up the archives and let people take a look-see?
Well, I would just say that if you look at what happened under Pope Francis, they did revise the guidelines as to what is considered a miracle, how to investigate or accept something as supernatural. And so the new pope probably will follow those same guidelines. It makes you kind of wonder why now, right? Is there something about now that they think might be coming down the road as to why they have to stay ahead of it and kind of have a standard by whereby they decide if something's authentic or not? So we'll see.
Why now? Because you and I are doing this interview, Ben. Everyone's going to watch it. Thank you for doing
That's right. You're welcome. Thanks, Ashley.
I always love having Ben Hansen on. He's so smart when it comes to this stuff. All right, still to come. The biggest break in one of the biggest and most vicious crime sprees of modern times. It happened 7 years ago today when police in California arrested one of their own, a former cop who turned out to be a serial killer and a serial rapist. His case kicked off one of the newest crime-fighting tools in modern history. And one of his victims who survived the attack is here with me next for our True Crime Rewind. Hard to believe that as of today, 7 years have passed since a watershed moment changed the way we find killers and lock them up. 7 years ago today, the Golden State Killer was arrested for more than a dozen murders and more than 50 rapes. His crimes were committed between 1975 and 1986, but he evaded capture for decades. And that's where the watershed moment comes in. They caught Joseph DeAngelo using forensic genetic genealogy, something we now take for granted. The 72-year-old was a former cop, but his DNA and his family tree did him in, and he was the first major criminal caught this way.
I think it's been a surreal, whatever it is, 8 days or something to get to this, and I think for the people sitting next to me, all the victims and their family members, it was a day that they never thought would come. Well, what's been reported in the last couple of days is that essentially the way that the road that we got to Mr. DeAngelo was through using, what I say, two things. One, genealogy, and two, very dogged detective work in terms of using that genealogy and trying to find the path to him.
We needed a better sample of DNA, and so we continued surveillance and got a better sample of DNA that we were able to do a full profile on, and that full profile, of course, led to that 100% match.
I've listened. All your statements, each one of them, and I'm really sorry to everyone I've heard.
It was a sham. He was not remorseful. He failed to apologize to important people. He left devastation in his tracks. I can never forgive him.
Mr. DeAngelo, I've listened for the last 3 days from the people you've terrorized and their friends and their family. Their impact statement will always be with me. I was moved by their courage, their grace, their strength, all qualities you clearly lack. When a person commits monstrous acts, they need to be locked away where they can never harm another innocent person. It is my sincere hope that with the opportunity to be heard these last few days and the sentence to be imposed, the survivors will find some resolution, will find some peace, and hopefully find some justice, however imperfect.
DeAngelo is now serving 26 life sentences without the possibility of parole. And my next guest spoke at his sentencing. Jane Carson Sandler was DeAngelo's fifth known victim, attacked on the morning of October 5th, 1976, in her own home. And what's particularly shocking about her attack is that her three-year-old son was in bed beside her. DeAngelo bound and gagged and blindfolded both of them. And after taking the boy from the room, he raped Jane for hours and then fled. By the time he was shipped off to prison, Jane told a reporter that she felt that she, too, had served a life sentence. And Jane is now with me live. Jane, it's good to see you again. It's the second time that we've had a chance to talk. And listening to that monster saying that he was sorry, I also listened to the judge saying that he hoped that victims would have some resolution and some sense of justice. Is there any of that?
Any sense of justice? Well, you know, right now he's in Corcoran Prison in California, and he is in a special area where other prisoners can't get to him. So he's being treated quite well, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, certainly better than he would be if he weren't in segregated custody. Are things any different now, given it's 7 years to the day today that he was arrested and unmasked, and then the process certainly put him away for life? Are things any different for you now?
Well, in the sense that I don't have to look over my shoulder all the time, you know, I still do. I'm very cautious, but I'm not, you know, looking over my shoulder all the time, you know, just wondering, is he still alive? Is he going to come back? You know, he said, if you report me, I'm going to come back and kill you. So I always, you know, had those thoughts in my mind, but, I'm so much at ease, much more at ease now that he's in prison where he belongs. One thing you just showed on your TV program was when he stood up during our, when we gave our impact statements, and he said he was sorry. All of us just gasped, could not believe he would say such a thing. It's like, are you kidding me? Oh my God, we just wanted to throw up. Because every other time you see this guy, you know, he's always in a, in a wheelchair, just looking for mercy, you know, oh, poor me. And then you can see him, they had videos of him in his cell room where he's doing all these calisthenics, running around and doing exercises. And so we knew he wasn't wheelchair bound, but to see him at the end stand up and say he's sorry, oh my God, I wish if we had tomatoes, we would have thrown them at him.
Yeah, I mean, a monster and a coward and a liar. I mean, every single adjective you can think of in the pejorative, you know, is fair game for him. Your son, 3 years old, it's so unbelievable to think that a predator could do this. Does your son have any memory of anything that happened?
He thinks that a doctor came into the room because, you know, we were gagged, we were blindfolded, and we were tied up. So really, that's all, you know, he remembers. Maybe if he was hypnotized, he'd come up with a lot more, but that's something I really never wanted him to be involved in. He never wanted to be part of anything to do with the story on D'Angelo. I think it was just because of the safety of his family. Because if he was still out there, you know, who knows what D'Angelo would do.
And he was a vengeful man. I mean, he would call victims and leave ghastly messages on their voicemails just to continue the terrorizing. Just an unbelievable story. Jane, it's nice to see you again after all these years. And I'm glad to see that you're doing well. And I really appreciate you joining me on this, sad anniversary, but also...
Are you going to be back in
Crime Con? Crime Con, right?
Yeah,
I think so. Yes, and I will probably see you again there. It was nice to see you there this year, and I'll probably see you again.
And I love your program. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you. I love your book. Bye. Let me give a plug for it. It's called Frozen in Fear, A True Story of Surviving the Shadows of Death. Again, Frozen in Fear, A True Story of Surviving the Shadows of Death by Jane Carson Sandler. And coming up next, another story about a Florida teacher. Only this story goes beyond the pale. Yes, like the others, sex crimes are involved. But police say this alleged monster agreed to a suicide pact with the student, but only one of them was left hanging from a tree. That story next. Teacher-student conduct can mean a lot of things. In the stories that we've been reporting on recently, and way too often, it has meant sex. Damaging, illegal, far from victimless sex. And it means that in this next story, too. But sex is not what put a 16-year-old girl in Florida in intensive care after being cut down from the tree where she was hanging. Police say a teacher helped her do that. Damian Conti was a former AP English teacher at a charter high school in Florida. Court filings obtained by the Palm Beach Post and other outlets allege that Mr. Conti began grooming the girl via email and text and social media back in August of 2023. Allegedly, he met her every morning at her locker and offered to be her mentor. Police say he gave her driving lessons and urged her to join the volleyball team that, oh, wouldn't you know it, he coached. And when she did join that team, he allegedly found reasons to take her out of practice and into a classroom alone. By the fall of that year, Coach Conti, who, by the way, was married with a 4-year-old child, allegedly opened up to the girl about his marriage and his sex life. And allegedly, he began to have sex with the teenager in a shopping center parking lot, but also in his classroom and in closets throughout the school. Authorities say Conti's behavior was so brazen and the rumors so rampant that school administrators gave him a warning, especially after a TikTok video made the rounds of the girl getting out of his car. But get this, he was only warned not to be in a car with students. The following February of 2024, a classmate discovered, quote, curious Instagram messages between the girl and a person who appeared to be Mr. Conti, Coach Conti. The classmate took the messages to the principal, and Conti was suspended. But despite the mounting evidence of sexual abuse, no one called the police. When the teenage girl was called into the principal's office, she reportedly refused to answer questions and asked for a lawyer, after which the principal told her to leave campus. No one ever called her parents. And 3 days later, that principal retired. But by then, the teenage girl was barely alive. According to the court records, when she left school, she met up with Coach Conti at a Home Depot. Security footage shows them inside the store together, the girl buying 30 feet of rope and 15 feet of chain with her mentor by her side. The plan, according to investigators, was for both of them to die by suicide. But Conti allegedly chickened out, and the two parted ways. Reportedly, he then called his therapist and asked what he should do next. And the therapist apparently said, hang up and call 911. And after 30 minutes of searching, sheriff's deputies found the girl hanging from a rope from a tree behind a church. They cut her down, and they resuscitated her, and they rushed her to St. Mary's Medical Center in West Palm Beach. Her lawyer says a miracle saved her life. Today, we reached out to the suspect's former employer, the South Tech Academy, and we got back this non-response. Thank you for your inquiry. Unfortunately, we are not at liberty to discuss ongoing legal issues. That's the end of it. Coach Conti is charged with, quote, unlawful sexual activity with a child and, quote, attempting to assist in self-murder. That's an interesting one. His trial is scheduled for June, and if he's convicted, he could spend the rest of his life in prison. And still ahead tonight, good news and bad news for police investigating a crime spree in Massachusetts. They finally got the culprit on video, dead to rights, full frontal, no mask. But there is zero chance of an arrest. The hitch in this foul play when we come back. This. Never get in the way of a pileated woodpecker during mating season. The good people of Rockport, Massachusetts know that all too well. The ones who own cars, anyway. They have finally solved a mystery that had plagued the town for weeks. Who was going around and cracking people's windshields and side mirrors, and why? And as it turned out, the culprits didn't bother to sneak around, wear disguises, or avoid cameras. And that was their undoing. Turns out the foul play was the work of pileated woodpeckers, which are big, almost the size of crows big. And the males, at least in springtime, are both randy and highly competitive. The experts say the boy woodpecker sees its reflection in the car glass, thinks it is a handsome rival, and goes to war. I never said they were smart. So case closed. But with more than 24 vandalized vehicles sitting in driveways and no one to arrest or sue, there are certainly a lot of ruffled feathers around Rockport. Get what we did there? We had clues. Would you believe? W-O-O-D. And foul play. F-O-W-L. Anyway, listen, check out my podcast, Drop Dead Serious, because if you're into the Karen Reed trial, I am doing a daily summary, a recap, every single day of what happened in court. And in tonight's, lots of text messages. They're steamy and they're angry and they're unhinged, and they may be Karen's undoing or maybe not, because Karen has a hell of a lawyer from Los Angeles in Alan Jackson. And also that video where Karen Reed mocks the mother of her dead boyfriend, a mother who is grieving just hours after finding her son was dead. So that's on Drop Dead Serious. I encourage you to check it out. Always love to hear your comments too. Thanks for watching tonight. Make sure you stay tuned.